Thank you for listening to the Ask AI podcast. To get our latest episodes, AI news, discount codes for events, and links to free resources, sign up to our monthly newsletter by visiting askai.org and clicking the subscribe link. That's askai.org.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ask AI podcast, where we talk to incredible leaders in the AI space. Today, we're joined by David Scharbach, who is a proud father, community builder, and founder of the Toronto Machine Learning Series, Machine Learning Ops World, ML Ops, Generative AI World Conference, and the Impulse AI LATAM event. With all these groups, he's run over 150 AI events and hosted over 700 speakers. He spends time working on various steering committees while exploring different ways to help promote the use of AI effectively, efficiently, and responsibly. This episode is sponsored by Cinci. Cinci is the enterprise data collaboration platform that enables people, systems, and AI to co-produce intelligent, reusable data products in real time. By eliminating data integration from IT delivery, Cinci also makes it virtually impossible to violate data protection controls as you leverage AI technology for your business. If you are an enterprise IT leader looking to de-risk and accelerate your AI journey, this is what you've been looking for. Visit Cinci.com to learn more. All right, David. Well, thank you so very much for being here.
You're very welcome.
I know we're going to have a wonderful back and forth, but first, I really just want to dig in. 150 events on AI and over 700 speakers. Like what? Like that is a lot of events about AI.
Yeah. You know, it's been a long ride. We've been doing it for, nearly 7 years now. So it's an amazing space to be in. No 2 days are the same. It's a lot of work, but it also gives us a lot of sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, I see you've been running the Toronto Machine Learning Society since 2016 and then ML Ops World since 2019.
Yeah, correct. So we started with the Toronto Machine Learning Summit, which our thesis was, you know, if we can get business stakeholders in the same room as practitioners, what we would have is clarity around some of the miscommunication that we were seeing within industry. And fast forward to 2019, we did a career fair. And there was about 70 companies participating, most of which were hiring for what they call data science positions. And what we found at the end of that evening event was the majority of the folks that were hiring were actually hiring for ML engineers. Some of the terminology wasn't there, whether or not they had realized the need for that specification. It was really at the forefront. So at that point, we figured we really need to do something that's more focused around the engineering and production.
And that's how ML Ops was born then, the going deeper into the...
Exactly. It was really a response to business leaders saying, okay, we've sampled, we've researched, we've invested in the center of excellences. Now we really need to see a return on our investment.
The commercialization piece, which again, as we know in Canada, not the best at, but so good at the research. And then all of that subsidized incredible research becomes the property of unfortunately often American entities. I don't know if you want to go there. Maybe it's too controversial too soon, but...
No. I think that's 100% accurate. And I would even go a step further and see a lot of the engineering that's coming out of Waterloo, for example, is top quality. If you go to Y Combinator and somebody tells you I'm a founder from Waterloo, it's up there with you know, MIT, Stanford, Berkeley. A lot of investors are immediately interested. So similar to the fact that, yeah, a lot of the research gets commercialized outside of our country, a lot of the top-end engineering as well often goes south. And unfortunately, that's something that we have to deal with, right? So part of the event was saying, okay, we really want to make sure that companies know what they're up against. They know how to begin with the commercialization of maybe the data that they have. They know how to work with teams, with engineers, with researchers. And I guess more importantly, on a broader sense, we're not just trying to replicate the Silicon Valley model, right? I think a lot of communities make that mistake where they're the Silicon Valley of the North or the Silicon Hills is what they're labeled in Austin. And I'm not sure that replicating that environment, you know, the population with the amount of funding, with the sort of ethos of break fast, it's just not for everybody. So I think I'm more of a proponent for carving out your own specific ethos within a community. And where that gets done is in, you know, community spaces, right?
Ooh, fascinating. So many things that we could dig into here. Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with the whole idea of like not replicating Silicon Valley. It is a special and unique place that many people, you know, fail to remember was also propped up by significant government dollars in the 50s and 60s after World War II, and especially with like space races and all that fun stuff. So much like how people knock the Canadian environment for having such heavy government investment, it's like, well, actually, this is exactly how the Bay Area started. If you look at that history, and I have seen some great articles on that, and I've got LinkedIn videos I posted about that history. So it's fascinating to me. But you're right, this whole idea of move fast and break things, particularly in AI, is dangerous. Like, it's so dangerous. Yes, we want to move fast. Yes, we want to innovate, but with the proper safeguards in place, right?
100%. Yeah. You know, I guess one of the criticisms of overstimulation from government funding could be SRED skeleton companies. So those are companies, startups that are only existing on SRED. Like, argument would be, okay, they need to die quickly so that they can, business owners can find a better model that's more sustainable. But also as well, I mean, they've launched a lot of companies. We're competing in markets that are very difficult if we're in comparison with the US neighbors, where there is an abundance of talent. There's a lot of investment where there's different risk tolerance, right, with those investors. But then also we forget that Jeffrey Hinton was funded through CIFAR, which was obviously a massive payout.
I mean, yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, when we talk about having a different environment and not replicating the Bay Area model, I mean, as you know, I was a founder from Sault Ste. Marie. I was trying to prove that you could build, I kid you not, this was my thesis. In 2016, I said, I want to prove that you can build a globally competitive AI company from anywhere. I would say I was proven wrong for now, but it wasn't really until 2020 that people really got on board with the from anywhere kind of vibe. And I do think this is an opportunity to reinvigorate communities. But, you know, I'd love to hear your perspective on like what I've seen as to what's holding back the Canadian environment is certainly funding, but it's funding in two particular ways. One, on the pre-seed side, because I've been there and I've gone to all the every single Canadian firm, all the notable ones in both Toronto and Vancouver and a bit in Montreal. And all of them were asking for, you know, what's considered Series A metrics when I was fully stating I'm a pre-seed company compared to the Bay Area counterparts. So that's one area I'd love your commentary on. And the second is when you talk about education and Waterloo and all these people and where they go and where they get hired. Once again, it comes back down to the dollars and cents, in my opinion. These are very much my opinions we can chat about. But it's also the money and it's the jobs. Like, what people are paid in Canada versus what they're paid stateside. It's just not comparable. And now cost of living has gotten so out of control in Canada, but wages have not even for tech workers, not even remotely kept up.
Yeah, those are two really interesting points. I mean, I guess some of the models that we'd want to compare to is propped up and maybe more aspirational might be the tech scene in Israel or in Portugal, for example. I think from an investment side, it's probably difficult to compare in the sense that, you know, the US is a large market. So by definition, a lot of the investors stateside have an opportunity to test and really drive some early sales just by sheer force of population, whereas we're kind of at a disadvantage where we have a smaller population. I want to speak to something that I find interesting, which is a collective bias that I think we also hold, right? I've seen this and I don't like it. I discourage it, right? And that's in the large part, gathering as a community, showcasing the talent, the ingenuity, the entrepreneurship and innovation that we have in part addresses this, because I think when you have a company that's local, for example, and you might be doing business with them, or you might be choosing to engage in some type of partnership with them, I think subconsciously, one of the things we say is, well, if it were that good or effective, why aren't they in Silicon Valley, or why aren't they, you know, stateside? And I think that's probably something that a lot of countries deal with. But what it means is that often companies are dealing with companies that are superior as partners or clients or consultants or dev shops or whatever it is, just by nature of the talent and sort of the tag that comes along with being in a larger ecosystem. So that's a bias that I think we have. We tend to not be so supportive of one another, and I'd like to see more of that. Yeah, so it's in terms of the VCs, it's definitely a criticism. It's, you know, if I can, I've heard this many times, if I could show you the metrics that you're asking for, I wouldn't be looking for pre-seed, right? And I probably wouldn't.
Amen. Say it again.
Yeah. So that's definitely something that we're up against. I would say that a lot of the companies from Canada, I mean, you look at Y Combinator and the companies that come out of that, there's some fantastic groups. But I think once we reach a certain stage, you know, if you want to scale a company, if you want to find some senior leadership for every one or two managers that you might find in Toronto or Ottawa or Montreal or Vancouver, there's probably 40 or 50 in the Bay Area. So that's definitely something that's a challenge. Not to say that you can't deal with that, you can't overcome it. And as well, one thing that's worth mentioning within sort of the Bay Area circles is that your intentions aren't necessarily to go to unicorn status. Sometimes the decisions you make as a startup are different. If you're okay with maybe 10 million in revenue or 100 million versus, you know, we're going for unicorn status. And the model for Y Combinator, just to go back as an example, is, you know, we're going for broke, right? So very early on, you need to make a series of decisions and trade-offs for optimizing the potential to make the utmost revenue possible. And that's just not for everybody. You know, some people are very happy with what would be still very lucrative, but perhaps medium or smaller size company.
So many good nuggets. I mean, I think a little bit of what you're hitting on is upskilling the talent across every level, not just technical talent. We have a lot of that, but like the sales talent in particular. We know when you're looking for sales talent, you're often looking, you know, certainly Bay Area, New York, but also like Utah, Colorado, Arizona. Those are hotbeds for top sales talent. And I love your, you know, call out of for every one in Canada, there's 50 here. And yes, our population is a 1 to 10, but it is disproportionate in talent. So that probably I have two questions for you, but I'll ask one right now that's possibly controversial. Do we think having all these large American companies moving into the Canadian ecosystem helps with the upskilling and gets, you know, maybe that ratio instead of being 1 to 50, it could be like 5 to 50, or better yet, 10 to 50, things like that. Do you think that could possibly be a upside of having these American companies here?
I do. I think it's an opportunity certainly for people to get more managerial perspective. Now, the question is, do they at any point want to leave? I think we've seen that in a lot of cases they do, but a lot of cases folks are interested in working within Canada, either moving back or maybe leaving a large American-based company or international-based company to work on a startup, to maybe work in another Canadian company. So I do think on the one hand, yes, that is the case. Now, there's arguments, right, for say, Amazon moving their an HQ or one of their large locations to Toronto. It also sucks up a lot of talent. So that's the other thing. But, you know, one thing that's interesting, you compare it to, say, Mexico, for example. I've been working to sort of conference in Latin America and building up some community there, but also getting an interesting opportunity to understand the markets better. And there's some really large unicorns. Mercado Libre is one, Rappi is another, that have managed to completely square off Amazon from their markets. So, you know, I think by proximity to a large commercial environment, it almost works against us, because again, the moment a startup starts showing some promise, it usually gets targeted pretty heavily from US investors. The moment talent reaches an aspect where they have, you know, one has the opportunity to work abroad and make more money, and that option's there. But I think if companies within Canada have great ideas, if they understand the problem that they're solving for, and if they are engaging in you know, with great teams, treating people with a lot of care and respect and understanding, right? I think sometimes, especially post-COVID, the quality of your working environment means a lot. And I think that there's a huge opportunity for people to move back and maybe get out of, say, a really high stress, large corporate environment and engage in maybe a company that's closer to home, maybe engage in a startup, work with a startup. And if you're in a leadership position, maybe you're you know, working with one of the local companies that we have here, because there's also really great opportunities to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. Yes, there's a potential for upskilling, but it also sucks up talent, and that having that balance is important. You know, when you talk about as Canadian companies get more successful and American investors get excited, I mean, I love that. I, for one, am all about taking that American money and putting it into Canadian entities and creating more jobs locally in Canada. That's exactly what I did with my business. I hired all Canadians, but I got most of my investment stateside, which was, you know, not preferred, but you know, to your point earlier, as soon as the US starts paying attention to you, then in Canada, they're like, oh, you must be legit. And it's like, I've been here, man. I've been here. I was legit when I knocked on your door first, and I'm still legit now that the Bay Area has funded me. Like, you could have gone in at a lower valuation. Like, I, you know, but I love US investment dollars going into the Canadian ecosystem. Like, that to me, it's wonderful. And I really encourage all Canadian founders to seek investment stateside. You do get better valuations, and then you can bring that money home. So this has been great talking about the ecosystem. I do want to talk more about you specifically and dig into your events. We talked a little bit about the origin story and some of that. And with all this Canada-US conversation, you've added a US-based event. So talk to me a little bit about that and what your goals were with that and why you made that choice.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I will say there's also, just to end on what we were discussing, there's some great Canadian investors as well, Georgian, Real Ventures, Panache. There's some good options here. So we went, there was, you know, in Canada, we had a couple of, you know, both sort of wider goals, I would say, and logistical reasons for having an event in the US. One of which is what we described, right? When in part with the conferences that we run, we want to make sure we're hosting business stakeholder interests. So in other words, non-technical content alongside technical content. And again, the thesis is when we get these folks in the room, it spurs more communication, cross-functional team communication, and greater understanding, greater projects. It allows us to put models into production more efficiently, effectively, and responsibly. But within the US, a lot of the case studies were very interesting, right? So we don't, you know, tech environments can turn into a bit of an echo chamber. We didn't want to do that. We had already been doing the Toronto Machinery Conference. We tapped into a lot of the companies here. A lot of the large organizations that are making significant investments in US have been speaking and participating to a certain extent. And sometimes with startups, for example, I'll give you one example. There was a car manufacturing company, and for every one seat out of, I think it was 1,000, they were manufacturing it incorrectly, and it was adding up and costing them a certain amount of money. They ended up hiring a startup for $10 million that was able to reduce this problem. They went off and solved that within 2 weeks, and then they kind of sat around and said, okay, what do we do next? But the problem, I guess the opportunity there is finding out what the main problem was, right? So for the startups that I see, and we all see them, and we listen to what they are working on and so on and so forth. A lot of times, just one client is the difference of really launching a startup into getting it off the ground and running. But the tricky part is just understanding what is that problem? What is that $10 million problem that you're looking to solve or that you can solve? It isn't necessarily that hard. It's just being at the right place at the right time, having access to that information. So one of the things that I'm always trying to do is promote case studies, amplifying those case studies as widely as possible so that our startup ecosystem can look and say, hey, you know, rather than spend the next 2 years trying to solve for this, why don't we shift a little bit, address something that's really urgent, might be simple, might not be as simple, might not need deep neural nets, but might use a wide array of our applications. And that seems like a really good idea, right? So we wanted to increase our exposure to different ideas, whether we're focusing in the pharmaceutical industry or manufacturing or retail. We're always looking to speak with companies and say, hey, what are the big key issues that you're having? What is something that, if solved, would save for potentially millions of dollars? Are you willing to talk about that? And if they are, that's always very helpful for us, right? So one of the reasons for going to the US was to say, hey, we have a lot of access to those ideas, to those shared case studies. And secondary was just logistics. So a lot of folks that were coming in from other parts of the world were, one of them was US-based, and the visa issue was challenging. A lot of our sponsors who helped set and prop up the events had been sponsoring the TMLS event, the Toronto Machinery Summit, as well as the MLOps one. So when we did it 2 years in one row, they basically said, we'd love to host in San Francisco, Boston, and New York. So we choose Austin in the middle of both coasts. And you know, it worked out well. It was really nice. We had people flying in from around the world. It was very communal. We had a couple sort of fun, creative meet and greet sort of opportunities for social, to spur the social component. Yeah, and that's sort of the origin story for us doing our event in the US.
Interesting. Okay. I hear you on the echo chamber in tech. I truly tried to even diversify, like, who I was following on Twitter, now X, to just not be in such an echo chamber all the time. But these case studies sound fascinating. So it sounds like you've got a big, long list of problems to solve. How does that influence your focus for events in 2024? Can you tell us, give us maybe a bit of a preview, whatever you can share about the focus for events in 2024?
Yeah. So one of the, obviously the big key area of interest right now is with generative AI and specifically large language models. I think that we'll see some advancements, and we're starting to see it in multimodal AI. So basically the intersection of large language models mixed with images, mixed with different mediums, voice, and so on. So I think that's going to be really come full circle. So we will be focusing a lot on that. Some of the things that we've seen this year, two main application areas are obviously conversation agents, but then as well, like information extraction within a company. So for example, if you're a legal entity and you want to reference a bunch of legal documents or old cases, having a model that can internally go over that information, extract for the user information relative to that company that would help them from going over and sparsing through that data themselves and will ultimately save a lot of time. The other thing with that that's nice is that it seems to be relatively safe in terms of the external risk to other clients or the public. It's trained on internal data and it's used internally. So these are the two main focus points that we've seen with generative AI, and we hope to focus on that quite a bit more. But then the other thing with a lot of the focus is, listen, we really want to focus on not these sexy wins that are often broadcasted across social media, right? Like we live in the AI space where you can easily turn on your computer, open up LinkedIn and be convinced that something's a brand new breakthrough discovery every other day. And it's not necessarily applicable, to say the least. And at worst, it can be really misleading, right? So there's a really interesting article. I can't remember the author. But it was basically programming for the other 99%. And the thesis was essentially, a lot of us modeling our AI teams or our programming on the micro scale and then on the macro, how we approach and put models into production on a larger scale, tends to be influenced by these blog posts that highlight the successes, underplay the losses, tend to publish right when they've shipped and the model's deployed, with very little follow-up, by the way, for when the model breaks or when the data or the current environment changes and it messes up and skews their models. These are the things that we don't necessarily talk about. But, where do we talk about these things? Well, one of the ways is at meetups. One of the ways are anecdotally through your friends and your conversations, if you happen to have somebody that's working in the same area as you, right? But publicly, you'd be convinced that machine learning is really offering, tens of millions of dollars of value without any of the complications, without any of the losses of money, time, or resources. And that's just simply not the case. So 2024 is also for us really focusing on let's discuss where this isn't applicable. Let's discuss where this does potentially fall short. Let's discuss some of the failures, because honestly, if I can learn from a company that's similar, maybe they're in a different industry, but their application area is similar to mine, what I can potentially do is save my team and myself, my company, tons of resources, hours of work, as well as financial resources, and so on and so forth. So focusing in on that is really important. And some of those discussions are around the tooling. That's been a really big one for us, right? So certain tools are really appropriate for certain sizes of teams. Certain tools and vendors and libraries are not, right? And that's just the reality. If your team is smaller, if your investment size is smaller, if you have certain types of data, if you're in different industries where they're highly regulated or not, these are all factors that you have to take into consideration. And that's just the exciting part about the world that we live in, but it's also the really challenging part is just sort of cutting through and finding your own path. There's no perfect tech stack. There's no perfect infrastructure setup that's going to solve for all your problems. There's no one perfect end-to-end solution. They don't exist. So a lot of times it's band-aids and duct tape, but some people seem to be a little bit further on in the maturity curve, and those are lessons that we hope to extract so that we can kind of rise all boats.
Yeah, it's so important to talk about failure, and I appreciate that you're creating spaces to do that, like safer spaces where people are willing to have those conversations, maybe not on stage, but in the hallways or in the small breakout rooms, because it's true. You see people talk about it privately. They don't really talk about it publicly for a whole host of reasons. And that is a detriment to the overall community. I love what you said about, well, we can save companies time and money and resources if we just said, hey, don't go down this path and try this. We've been there. We've done that. Here's what went wrong. You know, maybe try something else instead. So that sharing of failures is so fascinating. And your two use cases for 2024 on these conversation agents, information extraction, both of those are super real. I feel them now working at Cloudflare. It's huge opportunities for AI mm-hmm. to make a tremendous difference. So what makes a great community? If, you know, you've talked mm-hmm. about this is what you try to do that provides outsized value that isn't really happening in other places and spaces, you know, this talking about failure, sharing the case studies, figuring out mm-hmm. the problems to solve, and even which tools by team size or by industry, all of that. What makes a great community, and how do you make all these communities that you manage so great?
Well, first of all, thank you. I appreciate that. It's really the people within our group that have contributed to the conferences and made them what they are and made these gatherings what they are. I've had some really strong people that have helped. Tomi Putanen, the founder of Layer 6, is one of those people. RBC as a company has been a big sponsor of us and really helped us out. Armando Benitez is somebody within Toronto here, works for BMO, who's been a help as well. But I would say, like, one thing is that, you know, finding a common problem, right? You know, there's different communities that serve different needs. Typically, they tend to fall into two buckets, solving for one big problem or the promise of something larger, right? Once a community reaches a large enough size, it becomes hard to manage and there's a lot of noise, a lot of static, and you want to make sure that you're extracting value. Usually, that's when you have to coordinate it and filter it and make sure that you're organizing it in a specific way. And that has challenges, right? So, you know, that's one of the other things is, you know, then you have to choose, okay, how do you, usually that leads towards monetization in some form because you need somebody to invest in so that they can make sure that the community's continuing to expand and not just going completely off the rails. With us, it was conferences and events. And the one thing I would say as well with communities within the AI space specifically is, a lot of times people are just looking for opportunities to connect. And that's harder with us folks in the AI space. A lot of people are more introverted. A lot of people are potentially on the spectrum, right? We've seen that quite a bit. It's people's superpowers when it comes to really performing at a high clip and doing some incredible, incredible work. But what that means is that it's often difficult to meet people, right? So I've had this many times where we've gone into conference and people will come up and say, hey, I just want to introduce myself to the person next to me. I'm not really sure how should I do that? And we had to say, okay, well, like, you know, you start by talking about maybe some of the work, asking them about the work that they do and, you know, just really starting from square one. And I think our community is unique in that sense is that you have a lot of people that are on the basic challenges of just connecting it's unique, right? And that's a great thing. That's a great thing. The other thing is that just for communities in general, at the end of the day, I think a lot of people just want to connect. We want to live in tribes at the end of the day. We're tribes people, you know, it, by nature. So that means a lot of time spent on social media gives us an inadequate sense of connectivity. What we really need is to be able to meet in person. And I think post-COVID, there's probably the biggest need to connect with people and the least amount of interest and energy and capacity to do so, right? So you have to have these competing forces right now. So providing a safe space, providing an open space, that's become more important than ever.
Amazing. I thank you so very much for connecting with me. Do you have any final parting words, insights, a final nugget to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, well, I just want to thank you, Melissa, and thank Chris. I really appreciate the work you're doing. I think you guys have a really strong community. I think it's an example of leadership when it comes to a fantastic, well-oiled, very informative community that represents and empowers people. So I just want to tip my hat off to you and Chris for that. Yeah, no, I think if anybody wants to connect with me, feel free to do so. You can find me on LinkedIn. So I would encourage anybody who's interested in meeting people, sharing some of their own interests, as well as learning about the interests of others. It should be a really fun time. And I think it's a space if any of what we've discussed today resonates, it will be a space that's very awesome for anybody that's interested. So yeah, thank you very much, Melissa.
Yeah, thank you. Agreed. It sounds like you've used AI as an anchoring interest to truly actually build community and connection with people and like that human side where AI is just what gets you in the door, but the people is what makes you stay.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. way of putting it. The irony is that we are using our human social tools in a very human-like environment to discuss everything that tends to compete with that.
Ay. Well, thank you again so very much. Wonderful to have you here. Bye.
Thanks, Melissa. Take care.
This episode was edited by James Fajardo. Original music was provided by Mike Letourneau. The series producer was Chris McClellan. To view the episode transcript, stream the video version, and get helpful links, check out the episode post in the Ask AI blog.